You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. The Super Tuesday results are in, and there's a lot to unpack from the recent states that were able to weigh in on the next president. So we're going to be talking about that on this episode.
We're also talking judicial vacancies, how they screw over low-income people and compromise access to justice.
And then we've got Alan Pike once again from Think Progress to finally return and do an installment of The Weekly Worst.
Important for his ego. He was missing us.
Absolutely. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm now joined by my friend and colleague, Emily Tisch Sussman, who's the campaign director for the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Welcome to the program, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me, Tracy. I'm very happy to be here.
And you're calling from the car, right?
Yes, I am in transit. We are going to go talk about this topic and many other topics on TV, so I'm glad to join you guys.
I'm going to out you right now. She's going to Fox News, so kind of the opposite of this program.
So, well, we like to reach all audiences.
Exactly, exactly.
Our messages transcend.
Exactly. So we wanted you to come on to help us recap a little bit about Super Tuesday and also the Republican debate that took place in Detroit. But starting with Super Tuesday, you know, there was a lot of discussion around the fact that you know, evangelical voters seem to be going against their interests, that there's this rise in the conservative party, that the evangelicals are looking more towards Trump when maybe they should be looking more towards Ted Cruz. What's your take about what happened on the amongst conservatives on Tuesday?
Yeah, I think that's something that's really stumped a lot of particularly Republican strategists, that they've considered evangelicals as one of the most cohesive voting blocks, that they would tend to vote with people like them, who had similar views to them. And they really have, for the most part, moved away from Cruz, who people had felt like embodied that part of the field, and moved towards Trump, that actually has very different views from them in many ways. And people have attributed to a couple of things. They say that, you know, to some think that it could be the attraction to Trump, but some think that it also just could be that Cruz isn't very likable. And yes, he may have similar views to evangelicals, but people just don't like him. And so they're willing to break those voting habits.
And on the Democratic side, you know, obviously there were wins for both Clinton and Sanders. But there's a lot of talk about the southern states, because these are the most poor states in the country. These are the ones where I think that both candidates spend a lot of time, particularly because the African-American vote matters a lot there. Do you think that progressives need to create some sort of new southern strategy as part of this election season?
For sure. For sure. I think for the last couple of years, you know, the Democratic Party has sort of written off having large-scale wins in the South, and they're therefore not invested very heavily. But I actually think that progressive ideas really can win. There are very strong voting blocks there. And we have to consider the fact that there are, you know, as you said, there are a lot of, you know, really poor people in the South that really need good programs. And we can't just allow them to flounder. You know, I think we can look to no better example in the last couple of years than Medicaid expansion. A lot of people. So what happened under Obamacare is that there was a piece of the law that said that the states would cover Medicaid to X percentage higher than they have before. When it got challenged in the Supreme Court, that part of the law got struck down, and they said the states can decide whether or not they want to take that expansion for Medicaid. And many of the states with Republican governors, the governors rejected it out of principle, even though it would actually provide health coverage for some of their middle-class to poorest residents. They said, we are not going to take this just because it came from Obama, just because it's political. And what is happening is that there are real-life consequences to this. Like, there are real people who are living in this gap So they don't quite make enough to be able to qualify for subsidies, and they're not covered by Medicaid. So we have to be talking about how do we have strategies how to reach these people.
And something that's interesting is that we've seen this with Paul Ryan in talking a lot about poverty, and the Republican candidates are talking a lot about poverty as well. So this seems like this is an issue is primed to be part of the center of the general election as well. But how do we ensure that progressive messages about poverty are coming across, given the fact that conservatives are pretending like they're doing well on the issue?
Absolutely. And I think it's good that conservatives are now acknowledging that poverty exists, that it's a problem, that you can't just pull yourself out of any situation by your own bootstraps. I think it's a step in the right direction. But I think that we have to hold them to the real principles. We can't just allow them to tip their hat, check the box, they've said poverty. We have to say it's not good enough. You have to have real solutions that will actually help people. You know, I think we've seen this played out so far. I think part of the reason it's pushed the conservatives into this game is because we've seen it actually played out so far on the Democratic side of the field, that a lot of people have been very attracted to the Sanders message, because a lot of young people have been very attracted to the message. He has one message, right? Everything comes back to Wall Street, the system is rigged, right? Like, everything comes back to that. And people say, yes, throughout the system. And people haven't really gotten to the core of why it's done better with white people than with communities of color. And I think it's because in order for that message to resonate, it's because you actually have to believe that you have a right to the system. The system should be working for you, and that you should be able to access it. But I think for a lot of people, like, they're just trying to get by day to day, and they don't necessarily buy into that message. What do you think?
I mean, I completely agree with you. I'm nodding in agreement looking at our producer, Alyssa, because I think that you're completely spot on that for generations, African-American families have seen how you can work hard, you can, you know, buy a home, participate in the American dream, but you see that African-American middle-class children actually have downward mobility in this country. So even when you're playing by the rules and engaging in the system, it doesn't seem to pay off. So I think that you're completely spot on that these economic messages are going to resonate with white voters in ways that they don't resonate with people of color who just want to hear some plain speak on racial justice issues before we can even take a step towards how the system is going to finally work on their behalf.
Right. I think that's right. And he's had a lot of trouble acknowledging racial inequalities. And it sticks everything to economic. And there's no question that is a very big piece of it. But we are not so far from segregation. Like, we are still pulling ourselves out of it. And we have to acknowledge that we need a system that cannot just be equal for everyone, but equitable for everyone and have justice for everyone. And if you can't, you know, that's a piece that I think that he's struggled with. And I think that we are so far from hearing it on the conservative side. They think that equal is, you know, if they give everyone the same amount, then everyone can pull themselves up equally. But, you know, a lot of people just don't feel that.
Absolutely. And we also saw another important milestone in the election with the Republican debate in Detroit. And, you know, we're speaking about the differences between economic outcomes for people of color and white people. And something that plays really into this of whether the system works on your behalf is the situation in Flint. And the question finally came up in the debate last night. What did you think about the responses?
Oh, I thought it was wholly inadequate. I thought it was very disrespectful, not just to the people of Flint, but now we're now seeing that lead poisoning is rampant in the United States. We've seen, there's an article today about how it's even bigger in Cleveland. And there were actually protests outside that they obviously make no acknowledgement of. But to see the tone of the debate, you know, they were so fired up when they were trading insults, when they were, you know, trying to dump opposition research on each other. Then when they were finally talking about people who have really, they didn't start an even playing field, like they started poisoned. They don't have the supports around them to help them make up that difference. And then we're just going to abandon them. There was so little passion there. The only way they got passionate about it in any way was to defend the governor and to try to turn it partisan by saying that you know, Democrats are accusing Republicans of saying that they're waking up poisoning people. They think they're poisoning people every day. I don't think they thought they were poisoning people every day. I just don't think they thought about them. I just think they were so dedicated to the principles of cutting government and cutting costs, they didn't think about what it would actually do to their residents. And that's a problem.
Emily Tisch Sussman, campaign director for the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Tracy Ross. Recently, Reverend Al Sharpton, a national civil rights leader and president and founder of the National Action Network, joined the Center for American Progress ahead of the South Carolina Democratic primary. His remarks remain relevant to the remainder of the election cycle as he discussed key issues impacting people of color and the significance of their votes. Here's a portion of his speech.
As we are approaching the election the primary election for a Democratic nominee in South Carolina this weekend, and then both parties on Super Tuesday, we are going to begin to see the presence of people of color in big numbers at the polls. The question is what they go to the polls, what impact it will have, not only on the elections, but on the future of the country and on their communities. What has been very, very alarming to many of us in the civil rights community is that the concerns of people of color have been largely ignored until it becomes time to go and ask for their vote. So everybody shows up 2 weeks out, goes to the church, learns how to sing Amazing Grace, act like they have rhythm for an hour, and gone, and not to be heard from again until the next election cycle. So what many of us opted to do or say we're not going to play that game and we're not going to dance with you in that waltz this time. We want to discuss everything from police reform to economic disparities to the entire criminal justice system, mass incarceration, to environmental racism, i.e. Flint, Michigan, and across the board, including the very basic issue of voting rights. What one of the ironies of this election cycle to me is that voting rights has not even come up in the Republican debates, and only in passing in some of the Democratic debates, yet you're appealing to people to vote for you without dealing with the impediments of those very same people that are facing to even cast their vote. 15 states that will be voting in this presidential election have new laws about voting that they never had before. 15 states. And we're discussing the black vote like they're not major impediments in many states that will impair the black vote. Now, I remember in 2012, many of us engaged, National Action Network was one of the groups taking the lead on this, about fighting the new voter ID laws and fighting the new laws to bring back a cutback on early voting days and Sunday voting days, which we had all called Sunday sold to the polls. And when we began mobilizing around that after the Supreme Court had gutted a major section of preclearance, or at least the map for preclearance out of the Voting Rights Act, we began to mobilize people, and people were angry at their vote being robbed and their vote being messed with. And that contributed in many ways to the turnout and the long lines that you saw in Ohio, in Florida, and around the country. I was on the ground in Ohio and Florida around that time. And I talked to people on those lines who told me that I'm here, Reverend Al. Yes, I'm supporting President Obama's reelection, but I'll stay here all night before I allow them to take my vote. Well, this is a more clear and present danger this cycle, but the candidates are not even talking about it. We've reduced the campaigns to personality contests, like we're running for most popular in school, rather than policy and the direction of the country. And when you feed into personality politics, the result is you produce a Donald Trump, because then you're dealing with who's more colorful and entertaining than who's in your interest. So then the debate becomes who has the best soundbite or the best attack or the best line on your opponent, rather than who will deal with voting rights and who will deal with economic interests and who will deal with criminal justice and who will deal with health care. And I think that we've become prisoners of our own reality TV kind of culture now, where we're looking for the reality show with the best train wreck to entertain us before we go to bed and have nightmares and wonder where they came from. It, in my judgment, is the challenge of those that are serious about the direction of the country to have a sober analysis of where we are and a sobering of the electorate to get out of and refrain from this kind of worship of personality. Even on the Democratic side, do you like Bernie or do you like Hillary, as opposed to discussing their policies in these areas that I've talked about and their trust factor based on their backgrounds and track record on who will deliver and who will not, and who has a practical way of getting that done. We also have a particular point in history. There are two things that I want to raise on that. One, January 20th of next year, January 20th, 2017, in this city, we will face something that we've never seen in American history before. This will be the first time that a white will succeed a black president. We've never been there before. How America responds to that, we don't know. How black America will respond to that, we don't know. I was at the White House last night for the Ray Charles event. Last week, we had a meeting, intergenerational civil rights leaders, with President Obama. And as we were coming out of that meeting, one of my colleagues, who I won't name since there's press here, said to me, "Remal, we should have, we stayed an hour and a half. We were only supposed to be in for an hour. We stayed an extra half hour because we don't know if we'll be invited to Black History Month next year this time." I said, "We don't even know if there'll be a Black History Month in the White House next year this time." I don't think that we've locked in that the sense of outrage that many of us have around some of the situations near outline will even be more intensified when we see that black family walk out of the White House and head to Marine One for the last time and head to wherever they seek to go when they leave the White House. But as important is, which way will the ship of state go? With all of the critiques of Barack Obama, Barack Obama came in after 23 years of the ship of state going one way. We had Reagan 8 years, Bush Senior, going one direction. Clinton, who triangulated and kind of tipped it a little to the center, but was sort of midway. And then we go through 8 years of Bush. Obama turned back around this whole idea of government not being involved, government not confronting states' rights, whether it was on immigration, whether it was on criminal justice with Holder and then Loretta Lynch, this whole issue of criminal justice. In terms of the big picture of which way government was going, Barack Obama's administration turned it around in terms of a direction of going back toward government securing and protecting the rights of all citizens, not leaving it to the states. Well, we tend to now have the ship turned back all the way right. And if Trump is elected, I don't even know which way that means. And neither does anyone else. A lot of Trump's people say they're just mad and want to see something different. So I think that in that climate, the black vote and the Latino vote become critical, because in the states that are going to decide the nomination and the general election, critical states like Florida, like Ohio, like Pennsylvania, like Michigan, all of those states have critical blocks of black and Latino voters. The question is whether they come out to vote and whether they stay on long lines to vote, given the impediments to voting. So you've got to not only register them, you've got to inspire them. Before you can turn people out, you've got to turn them on. And unless we get past personality cult politics and deal with the policies that mean something to people every day, the turnout and the turn on will not happen. Now, Nir is right. I do talk radio every day, 3 hours a day. A lot of my list, every state of the union I'm on in and every region of the country, I get callers every day, young and old. One of the reasons that I and National Action Network are so involved is because I talk to people. A lot of people talk for people they never talk to. A lot of people leading folk they don't even like. I talk to people every day on the air. That's why people can tell me whatever they want to tell me. I get on the air the next day, run into my audience, and let the feedback tell me many times stunning to me, because I go with certain assumptions that end up not being the flavor. Now, I'm not saying talk radio gives you the flavor of everybody, but it gives you a pulse, because the average person that listens and engages in talk radio will vote because they're involved. And when I get a lot of the response from people every day, then as I tour, I'm preaching tonight in Miami, on my way from there to LA. As I talk to people in churches, as I talk to people in the street, as I talk to people on college campuses, people are saying that I'm not hearing things that mean something to me personally. I'm not a political junkie. I'm not that involved. So why should I go and risk standing in line 5 hours? I might go to vote, but if they say my ID was in question or I moved or they can't find my card, what is it in it for me? I wanted to make a statement with Barack Obama. I wanted to be there to elect the first black president. I wanted to be there to turn the country around. But what is in it for me? That's the challenge of this election. And I'm so happy Nira said what she did, that it is not just one issue. Certainly, a lot of what we've done has been around police reform. But police reform is one of many, and a lot of the police community stuff emanates from other economic and environmental and social ills. When the first of the cases of this last wave was the Eric Garner case in New York, where a man was choked to death on video saying, "I can't breathe." This was July 2014. I was in Nevada on a voting rights tour when Eric Garner's wife contacted us the day he was killed and asked us to be involved. Like most public media, we never get involved in cases. I'm talking now as an organization, National Action Network, and head of our Washington Bureau is sitting here, Ebony Riley, and stand up, Ebony. And Faith Blackburn that handles our interfaith with Congress and all. When we got the call from the Gardners, I left Nevada the next day. He was killed on the Thursday. Had them at our rally. Every Saturday morning, we have a rally in Harlem, live on the radio, 200 people there, 200 to 300 there. While we were fighting the Gardner case 3 weeks later, I get a call from a man who said they killed my son, my grandson, in Ferguson. So I'm in the middle of the Gardner case when Ferguson happened, flew there, did the first rallies. All of this in the context of we were still fighting voting rights, in the context that we were still fighting to maintain the Affordable Care Act, which is why we cannot reduce this to a one-issue problem, because then the suggestion is, well, let's put a Band-Aid here rather than deal with a systemic problem of inequality in this country.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we're joined in studio by our friend and colleague, Anisha Singh, who is the campaign manager for Legal Progress here at CAP. Welcome.
Hi, Anisha.
Hi. Thank you guys for having me.
Of course.
So, Anisha, before we bring you into this conversation, I have to get something off my chest. I recently learned that Tracy has been moonlighting and has been doing voiceovers for videos here at CAP.
I've done two voiceovers. I'm very proud that my voice has been honored in such a way. As a voiceover artist, I'm particularly proud of the Just a Judge video that we recently did. I couldn't really explain it to you. I just read the script, but luckily Anisha wrote the script and can explain to us why it was an important video.
So we brought her in to help us with this. So the Just a Judge video, which we'll go to a clip of it in just a second, looks at judicial vacancies. When a judge retires or steps down or is for some other reason unable to perform their duties, you end up with a vacancy on a court, and that can have ramifications, particularly for low-income people, and that was why the Legal Progress team did the video, but it's also why we wanted to do this segment. Let's go to the video now.
This is Martha. She would make an excellent judge. So when there's a vacancy in the federal court system, she's a shoo-in for a speedy confirmation, right? Not necessarily. Here, in a few not-so-easy steps, is how a judge becomes a judge. When a judge decides to retire, she usually gives a year's notice. This seems like a lot of time to find someone like Martha to replace her, but in reality, legislative stalling and bureaucratic delay can leave vacancies unfilled for months and even years. While they wait, Americans with cases in federal courts are denied access to justice. So that's just a clip of it. It's got the kind of a Schoolhouse Rock feel to it. But can you briefly, in your own words, Anisha, explain kind of what the process is for confirming a judge and why we have such a backlog?
Absolutely. So it's actually a really complex procedure, and people don't really understand. We all understand how a bill becomes a law, you know, how we
also
elect.
Thanks to Schoolhouse Rock.
Yes. Right. And so that's where the idea came from for this video. You know, we all know that video. We all know how a bill becomes a law, but none of us know how a judge becomes a judge. But it actually has a lot of steps, I think about 8 to 9 steps. And it allows for our senators to block or stall a nomination to being confirmed that the president might have put through. And while our founding fathers decided that there should be 3 separate branches of government, this is one of the ways that that kind of gets in the way of having a smooth process. So just to go over that process generally, when a judicial vacancy occurs, like Rebecca mentioned, the president first nominates a qualified judge. Usually he does consult with home state senators on who would be the best option for that. So from the get-go, the home state senators are supposed to be working with this president to put through a nomination.
And this is something people have been talking a lot about in the wake of Justice Scalia's passing. That obviously then leaves a vacancy on the Supreme Court. But you're talking about courts across the country, so lower courts, not just the Supreme Court. This is something where that happens too.
Absolutely. This is more targeted towards the district court and circuit court. But the same process happens with the Supreme Court, where the president nominates someone and then the Senate has to confirm. The difference is with district courts and circuit courts, there's a few more extra steps that have come into place. They're not even in the books, but they're just procedures that have eventually become tradition. One of those being, once a president nominates someone, senators from the home state of the nominee are then responsible for submitting blue slips of paper to demonstrate their approval. These are literally just sheets of paper that say, I approve of this nominee, and they turn it in. From there, the Senate Judiciary Committee has to hold a hearing. From there, they have to hold a vote. And only then can there be a confirmation vote in the Senate. And so we've seen a lot of stalling in some of these processes. A great example is Judge Felipe Restrepo. He was a qualified judge, Hispanic judge. He had previously been a district court judge, was going to be a circuit court judge. And he had to wait 6 months before Senator Toomey turned in his blue slip. From there, the Judiciary Committee didn't hold his hearing or vote for another 6 months.
Jeez.
At the end of it all, it took 14 months before he was confirmed, even though when he was confirmed for the district court, it was with unanimous consent.
So Senator Toomey, of course, a senator from Pennsylvania who is a Republican.
There's enough steps along the way where politics can interrupt a process for even a judge who is confirmed unanimously. So it just shows how trying this process can be, which makes sense of why we have such a big backlog.
Absolutely.
So tell us about the backlog. So part of what you look at in this video and part of the work that you've been doing here at CAP is to look at not just the process of how a judge becomes a judge, but when vacancies are dragged out because all of those steps are not really permitted to go forward, or when politics gets in the way and holds up filling those mm-hmm. vacancies, there can be consequences for the courts and for people who are seeking to access the courts. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. And it's just like how we have seen unprecedented obstruction with everything else that President Obama has put through. The same thing is happening here. We are seeing the largest backlog of federal criminal and civil cases in American history and the slowest confirmation rate since 1960. So just to give you an idea, right now we have 90 total vacancies, and 31 of those are emergencies. An emergency occurs when the court feels like they can't even handle the caseload anymore and they desperately need someone to be put in that place. We're seeing judges across the nation traveling hundreds of miles to go to a different district or a different town just to hear cases because there's a vacancy. We're seeing judges who want to retire who can't retire because there's going to be just way too much backlog, and they just don't want to have that happening.
So we brought you on because this has real ramifications for people who need their day in court, and particularly for low-income people. You wrote a piece recently for TalkPoverty.org titled How Judicial Vacancies Threaten Access to Justice for Low-Income People. And you opened with describing a case in California of migrant workers. Can you tell us about this case and how this illustrates the fact that these backlogs have real consequences?
Sure. In California, there are migrant farm workers who have waited over 3 years to hear from a federal court on whether they can proceed with a class action lawsuit against their employer. This is thousands of migrant workers who are on this case, and it's basically alleging wage theft in the form of back pay. But because of the judicial vacancies, justice is hard to come by for these workers. And because of the transient nature of migrant labor, they might not even be in this position or even in the same town or state by the time this even gets heard. Waiting 3 years just to hear whether or not they could proceed with the class action lawsuit is, again, another form of unprecedented obstruction.
So we end up in a position where wage theft is illegal. There are wage and hour laws in place that protect workers and that are especially important for low-wage workers and for migrant workers like these folks that you're talking about. But you end up with this sort of second part of the process that isn't happening, which is their ability to enforce the laws that are on the books.
Absolutely.
And you wrote that the large number of vacancies has wreaked economic havoc on communities. Can you explain how this has had economic consequences?
Sure. So in Texas, we have the largest amount of vacancies of any other state. There are 11 vacancies right now. Again, this is an unprecedented number. The second most is in Alabama with 6 or 7. So just to give you an idea. And in that state, there was a study done last year that revealed that if only of two of those judicial vacancies were filled, it would likely lead to the creation of over 78,000 jobs and an increase of $11.7 billion in economic activity by 2030. And it's because it increases personal income, workers' earnings, and retail sales, and it just creates a stability factor that right now we just don't have in our court system.
So not only are the political games that people are playing to stall these vacancies are denying people their day in court, but it also has a ripple effect in these local economies.
Absolutely, yep.
Now, we've talked a little bit about the sort of the civil side, right, like wage theft, for example, which can have an impact on people's ability to access income that they've earned, as you were just talking about with this one study. But there's also consequences on the criminal side. What happens in the criminal courts when we've got these kinds of vacancies?
So, you know, almost 90% of criminal cases go through the state court system, but there is a large percentage, and 10% is a large percent when it comes to these cases that go through the federal court system. And in those cases, we're seeing that a lot of felony cases have doubled to 13 months before they're even heard. And sometimes what this creates is a plea bargaining mills, where defendants are incentivized to plead guilty, even if they are innocent, to end waiting periods spent in prison that can far exceed the actual sentence of the offense.
So to break that down, you've got somebody who they are in jail. They're awaiting their day in court. They haven't been found guilty of anything yet. Maybe they can't afford to post bail, or they haven't, for some other reason, been allowed to get out while they're waiting for their day in court. But while they wait for trial, which can be, as you were just discussing, like more than a year, they end up in a situation where they get desperate. That's basically what you're saying, and they have an incentive to plead guilty. And is this is something that you write is being made worse by these vacancies?
Yeah, because the more vacancies that exist, the longer it takes for a case to be heard, because these judges are juggling a lot more cases than they anticipated. So that's taking a longer time for these cases to be heard. And lawyers are incentivized to tell their clients, listen, you're better off just pleading.
There's a particular line in your Talk Poverty post that really stuck out to me, that there was a criminal defense attorney in the Eastern District of Texas who, having watched all of this play out there, characterized the state of affairs as that prosecutors will actually use the delay in felony cases and the delay in people accessing their day in court as what he described as a hammer over a defendant's head. So basically, people are hearing the message, he argues, plead guilty, and that's the way to get out of jail.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's what we're seeing across the board. And so I don't think these senators understand that while they're playing these political games, it's actually affecting people's lives. And now they have this on their record.
And one thing that I'd be interested in hearing from you, we started talking about this a little bit before air, But you were talking about the importance of getting progressive judges on the bench. And, you know, again, a great example after Scalia passing these debates that we're having on the national stage about whether or not Obama will be able to appoint somebody comes down to the fact that the political balance on the courts really does have an impact on the American people. Can you go in a little bit about why it is necessary to fight for progressive judges?
Absolutely. So, you know, right after Scalia's death, before the country even had a chance to mourn, Republican senators were taking the mic to talk about obstructing his replacement and talking about not even holding a hearing. And that's never happened in the history of our nation either. And what this means is if we have an 8-justice court, there will be a lot of 4-4 decisions, meaning that there will be 4 judges that will agree to uphold something or not. And what that does is when there's a split like that, the lower courts decisions stand. And so we go back to the conversation about these district and circuit courts where there are so many vacancies. If we fill them with progressive judges who have the same values that the American people need, then we will see that those lower court decisions are what we need to see. And when situations like this happen, we don't have to worry about, you know, that standing as a law that will be implemented with the Supreme Court. For example, right now, the Fifth Circuit is the reason why we're seeing so many of these cases in the Supreme Court. The Fifth Circuit being from Texas. Texas is the state that we were just talking about that has 11 vacancies. If we fill those vacancies with progressive judges, we would have better case outcomes coming out of that state so that we're not seeing some of these cases that are threatening 5 million people for immigration, 1 million women who would have to travel 150 miles just to get to an abortion clinic, 7 million workers who might not be able to be a part of a union. You know, these type of numbers are threatening our society and low-income individuals because of the fact that we don't have progressive judges currently in courts and that we have these judicial vacancies where we desperately do need those progressive judges.
So we have an election going on, obviously, and people are rallied around various candidates. Is there a way that the public can hold people accountable in terms of vacancies on the court? Because I think people like to think about the executive branch and they like to think about the legislative branch, but I think the average person doesn't really think about the role necessarily of the judiciary.
Yeah. So getting in touch with your home state senators, that means the 2 senators that are in your state that represent you in the U.S. government, getting in touch with them and telling them to do their job. You know, right now we've seen, I think today the numbers came out, 47 Republican senators have said they will not even hold a hearing for a potential nominee for the Supreme Court. That's a lot of people in these states that can activate around these 47 senators to tell them to do their job. Senators listen to their constituents. That's who they count on to stay in office, and it's your job to tell them to do their job.
Anisha Singh is the campaign manager at Legal Progress here at the Center for American Progress and one of our dear friends. You can find her Talk Poverty piece, How Judicial Vacancies Threaten Access to Justice for Low-Income People at talkpoverty.org, of course. Anisha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. You didn't sound really sure of who you were going to be right now.
Really?
But we
was
also...
Was there a question mark at the end of that? Was that like
it
the
was
classic,
cautious.
It was like the classic woman thing, ending every sentence in a question
it
mark?
It was more cautious. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And we're also joined by Alan Pike.
Hello.
Alan, do you know who you are?
Some days.
Is today one of those days?
No, not especially.
This is going to be a great segment. As always, Alan...
Welcome back to the Existential Poverty Hour.
I know. Alan,
who are any of us really?
With us to present 3 horrible stories related to poverty, and we're going to vote on which is the worst of the week.
And at the end of it, we'll check back in on how we're feeling about who we are.
Yeah. So, Alan, what is the first nominee?
There are 12,000 American women who get turned away from domestic violence services centers on any given day, according to a survey from the National Network to End Domestic Violence. The group's annual survey shows that lack of resources at DV service centers are having an increasingly harmful effect. The daily turnaway number that they estimate was down below 10,000 as recently as 2013. So a mere 10,000 women were getting turned away from these centers in 2013, now up to 12,000 and change. And this is being driven by a mix of federal budget cuts and apparently also a pullback from private donors. That's according to the reporting of my colleague Bryce Covert, who wrote about the survey for thinkprogress.org.
So I feel a little maybe naive or bad that I didn't realize the extent of the problem, because I thought you were going to say 12,000 a year. I didn't realize it's each day, you said.
Yeah.
God, that's horrifying.
Yeah, I had the exact same. When Bryce posted this and I went to read it, it took me like a minute or two to sort of realize, wait a minute.
Yeah,
that per this day?
Every
and,
single
and,
day.
And they're very clear that the way their survey methodology works, they're talking to centers on a given day. And so this is on any given day,
sure,
number may be X, not a every single day of the year.
Right,
X.
Right. So it's so a it's, point
you shouldn't
in time
extrapolate
count
to a full year total from that 12,000 and change number, but an alarming situation.
And we've explored the intersection previously on this show, right, of sexual violence and domestic abuse and how that can lead to economic precarity. It's obviously extremely challenging in a lot of ways to leave an abusive situation. But if you don't have your own bank account, if you don't have a place to go, if you've got kids in tow and you're trying to figure out what life is going to look like, tomorrow, let alone months down the road, that can make it extremely challenging. I think this reflects a national crisis, right? We don't have places for people, by and large women, to go if they're escaping these kinds of situations. I can't believe this
exactly
isn't getting more press.
And this is one of the many reasons that I cringe when people are like, well, why didn't she just leave him? Or why didn't, in other cases, why didn't he just leave their partner? It's
yeah,
a victim blaming. But also for a lot of people, they're weighing the pros and cons of being homeless or hopefully being able to tolerate the abuse for
right
an evening.
And that point about our pattern, that human pattern of reacting to traumatic events with that kind of challenge to the victim's experience, I think is really fundamentally about how badly we all want to believe that we would never end up in that situation. And something like this that illustrates how the collective societal efforts we make to facilitate people reaching that survivor class that we all find so noteworthy and so noble from these dire circumstances, there's this collective investment that we say we're going to make in making that kind of survival possible and facilitating it for people, and we're underfunding that in ways that have real human consequences. And I think that plays back into that sort of desire we all have to view ourselves as totally incapable of ever ending up in that situation.
Right, exactly. Because this is an example of these 12,000 individuals. Maybe on that day they were trying to leave and then ultimately had to return.
Right.
So Alan, what else do we have on tap?
Los Angeles is seizing and destroying tiny houses that were donated to homeless people in the city. They say the mini dwellings violate building codes and cannot be sited legally on the freeway underpasses and medians where tens of thousands of homeless Angelenos sleep every night. These are portable, crowdfunded houses that started popping up last summer. And at the same time that somebody started building and donating these spots, Los Angeles officials were busy declaring a homelessness state of emergency in the city, caused in part by chronic underfunding of affordable housing programs.
So they can't possibly have anything on the books that are saying tiny houses have to be built in this type of way. How are they actually saying that these structures are not okay?
I assume that it's that they're not up to various codes that govern a dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be. You write the rules of what a dwelling looks like.
If the
construction method.
This mirrors situations that we've seen and talked about on the show before when it comes to food, right? So you end up with the non-government organization that is trying to feed homeless people in a park, for example. Example, and they get shut down
right
because, oh, wait, it might not be up
right
to, whatever code. And the stated reason by the policymakers is, oh, we just really care about
right
food safety. And we
right
we would hate that there would be some kind of unsafe or hazardous food that would be served to these people and they would then get sick. And that we're trying to look out for them. But the reality is then people end up going hungry. This is going to be simultaneously while the city is saying they care about homelessness. This is going to put people right back on the street.
Exactly. And I feel like the truth of the matter is that City officials, law enforcement, selectively enforce laws.
Absolutely.
You know, there are plenty of landlords who are not being held accountable for the quality of their structures. There's a variety of things that are impacting people across the city of Los Angeles that aren't taking that aren't a high priority for law enforcement officials. This is really comes down to them not being concerned with the safety of the people in these tiny homes. It's just that they don't want to have visible evidence of homelessness. Yeah. that they think it's blight, really. And so I don't buy, I'm sure you guys feel similarly, I don't buy that this is something that's just seen as a real priority.
Yeah, and if you go back to the Los Angeles Times article that I picked this up from to write it up for Think Progress, it's pretty explicit in that piece that this is driven by NIMBYism, that a number of people have called their city councilman or somebody else to express concern and anger and outrage about having to, you know, walk through these homeless encampments that are so common in Los Angeles. And that's the thing, is that they're not just tearing down these tiny houses that give somebody a roof and some privacy and a door that locks. They're talking about clearing out any significant encampment of homeless people, which is something that the federal government's interagency working group on homelessness now explicitly says is a lousy approach to encampments. And it's part and parcel with the broader criminalization of homelessness, which, thank God, HUD is finally starting to factor that into their funding formula for local and state homelessness advocacy work. So sometime in the near future, we may start to see places that criminalize homelessness and treat the day-to-day business of being homeless as a crime. We may see those places start to lose out on some federal funding, which might actually drive things back in the right direction.
It brings to mind the Anatoly France quote, in its majestic equality, the law forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, beg in the streets, and steal loaves of bread, right? I mean, we've got
quote.
A policy on the books. We have to apply it. But funny, who else is living in tiny houses?
Right.
Rich people?
Right.
Yeah, because that's totally where they're living.
Exactly. Right. And we've said this, I think, multiple times throughout the Weekly War segment over the past year, but it costs three times as much to have homeless people involved in our emergency system. So whether it's law enforcement or ERs, costs three times as much than just providing housing. So I could see this as falling into that category and being not only a inhumane solution, but an economically foolish one.
Yeah.
Where's our friend of the show, Alex Lawson? Cruel,
I know.
And stupid. It passes both prongs
exactly,
of the test.
Exactly, exactly.
And the other thing here is, I think that certainly I had this perception in the years before I started actually reporting on homelessness and asking questions that I didn't have answers to. I think that the common perception with Los Angeles and homelessness is, well, yeah, sure, there are all these, you know, teenagers who want to be actors who get a Greyhound ticket from Nebraska and don't make it, and so they end up on the street, and that's why Skid Row is there. And that may be part of the story, but there's a reason that homelessness in Los Angeles is measured in the tens of thousands, not just in the thousands as it is in other major cities, but the tens of thousands. And it's partly that the state as a whole has vastly pulled back its investments in affordable housing over the past couple of years. Out of budget concerns, about 4 or 5 years ago, Governor Jerry Brown killed the state's annual funding of about a billion and change for affordable housing construction. It's never been restored. There's a proposal in the state legislature to try to gin up some new money for that, but the governor has been quite clear that as far as he's concerned, the resources aren't there in the treasury, and so they're just not going to restore those funds. So at the same time that other economic factors have driven people onto the streets, there's been a decreasing supply of places where they might actually be able to afford to live.
And that's why the tiny houses movement has been so exciting.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, because it's basically, and you mentioned it's crowdfunded, right? This is people collectively working together saying government is failing in providing a critical service. We're going to do something creative here to give people an option.
Right.
I know we need to let you move to the third one, but we're all outraged by this one.
Yeah. All right. So what's the third story?
Well, Wisconsin is going to make it a lot easier for debt collectors to go after people in court.
Our friends in Wisconsin.
Indeed. our friends in Wisconsin. Passed a law in late February that's going to reduce the burden of proof in debt lawsuits. So right now, if a debt collector takes you to court, they have to demonstrate how they arrived at the dollar figure that they're asking a judge to enforce. Because, you know, when a collector sues you, essentially what they're doing is asking the legal system to put the full force of the law behind their claim on your money, which means they might get permission to garnish your wages. They might get first dibs on your IRS refund check. They might be able to put a lien on any property that they can track down that you own. These really invasive tools for collecting a debt. So it makes sense intuitively that before you allow a judge to agree to that, that you want to at least see some receipts, right, on why it is that the collector is claiming you owe this exactly $136.14 or whatever. Current law is they have to provide documents that substantiate how they arrived at that figure. The law that they just passed in February, once Governor Scott Walker signs it, is going to mean that collections agents only need to assert the amount that they're claiming, not prove how they arrived at it.
Classic. God. Absolutely classic.
This is not surprising, but it's horrifying. So what?
These are not exactly the most scrupulous actors, by the way.
What is the argument? Is that it's just, why would they possibly cheat anyone? This will make things, the court system, smoother.
Well,
the
surface argument, at least, is that state courts have interpreted existing Wisconsin law in a variety of different ways to mean a variety of different things. And so there's this sort of fog of law in the collections courts in the state. I don't know enough to know whether that's a particularly credible argument. I do know that in the previous legislative session, the same bill came up, and Walker's own agency for financial institutions, the Department of Financial Institutions, I think it's called, sent an undersecretary to testify on the bill who said, hey, guys, this is a crap idea for the following reasons. We're very concerned that this will abrogate consumers' rights in these ways.
And then let me guess, how much was spent in lobbying in the past year by the industry?
You guys love to ask me questions I didn't bother to look into when I was writing.
You could just make up an cross-examining you.
The weird thing is they bring it up a year later. They bring somebody from the DFI to testify again. But this time, there's no record of what the DFI person said. last time there was a document of prepared testimony from.
Was there just a blank like 18 minutes of tape?
There was no tape. There was just a PDF.
Is that like a contact reference?
That was
Watergate, Tracy.
Contact is a hell of a movie.
That's the same thing.
Can we have a separate show that's just talking about Jodie Foster movies? Can I come on that too?
I think we should. We'll do a
we'll
Jodie
figure
Foster
out the connection.
Segment.
But anyway, right. Stay focused. I'm sorry.
Anyway, the point is, once this is signed, it's going to make it a lot easier for debt collectors to sort of reach a gloved hand in, say, your bank account and your other property. Even though this is an industry that operates often off of spreadsheets that they've purchased from somebody who purchased the spreadsheet from somebody else, who purchased the spreadsheet from somebody else. And so nowhere along that chain of transactions is information necessarily getting updated. So there's lots and lots of bad paper, as they call it, in the secondary debt market. It's now going to be a lot harder to prove that you're being screwed over by unscrupulous collectors in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, and it's going to be also a heck of a lot easier for the industry to come in, or the debt collectors on behalf of, you know, however many chains of attenuated, kind of passing onto the files have happened, the debt collector will come in, they will file suit. And often what happens in these cases is people end up with default judgments against them.
Exactly.
Because they don't get notice that that the suit was brought. Maybe they've moved a few times.
Right.
The notice doesn't make it to them. They don't show up in court. And then all of a sudden, boom, default judgment means that debt is now on the books against you and you can't challenge it anymore.
Right.
And if they don't have to prove at the outset that the debt is real and here's the paperwork to back it up, those default judgments are going to go through the roof. I propose we do a full segment on this at some point.
Absolutely. So we're getting the signal that it is time to vote.
Alyssa is strict today.
The polls are closing.
So I feel like we thoroughly went through these stories. Obviously, as always, they're all horrifying, but I'm going to vote for the first story about the amount of women turned away from domestic shelters who are experiencing domestic violence. Just because it's exactly to what you said, Alan, that we hope that people can walk away from their abusers, and when they try to, we're not the system is set up to punish them once again, and it's just horrifying. So I vote for one.
It's hard not to vote for number one for all the reasons that you laid out and all of the discussion we had before. I think I have to vote for number three, and maybe I'll make that an anticipatory protest vote for you, Alan, because I think I know what you're going to vote for. But I mean, we have to dig into this issue. This is something that could saddle low-income people.
Absolutely.
With all sorts of debts that are really going to be enormously crippling.
Yeah, and I'm voting for number one, but mostly just for the opportunity to prove once and for all that I care more than you do about domestic violence, Rebecca.
Oh, wow. A petty vote for an important issue. guess, you guys.
That's how we make decisions.
All right. We'll have a contest at some point about which of us founded Take Back the Night at our alma mater in undergrad.
More pettiness.
Contest might not be the word for that, actually.
And on that note, we'll dive deeper into both of those issues on further segments. But thank you, Alan, for joining us once
again. Pleasure as always.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.